Unity, who has maybe donated over time to Street Books, brought us books.
Was that the one just about a month ago near the Schnitzer?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So that was there.
Oh, good. Yes. Okay, yeah. So that was a fall event. We've done a fall event for something like a decade. And it's just a chance to appreciate another successful season of summer shifts outside before we transition to our fall and winter programming. But one thing that I would say is a change in our programming, and it has to do with the pandemic. I wrote a community grant. We scored a sweet space at the EcoTrust building, which always has felt slightly fancier than we really are. But, you know, when it's a fundraiser, we think, well, okay, we can all like
the
wear
Pearl District,
a bolo tie or something.
But again, there's that fine line between the Pearl District and Old Town.
Well, yes, very fine, right? And so I think that one thing we realized after the pandemic forced everybody to kind of hunker down for a year and not have events that drew people together is that even on our best events, even in the case of an event where a number of patrons we were able to give rides to, we were able to coordinate so that we had folks come, there might have been 10 to 12 patrons indoors with the larger community. And we began to really look at that model and wonder if that was all we could do. And so the following fall, we had an epic unpermitted, which I probably shouldn't say on the radio, event outside of the Portland Art Museum. And it was beautiful. Julie Keefe, the artist, and Larry Yes were there with a letter writing kiosk, a love letter writing kiosk. We had a vigil to demonstrate against the sweeps and to hold the people that had passed in, under our watch, our patrons we'd lost. And then we had a beautiful meal, and it was all outdoors, and we were amazed at how many of our patrons were able to be there, some who'd traveled across town and some who'd left places where they were sleeping or belongings and sort of had to make that risk. And so we realized that that was what we wanted to do going forward. We did not want to have an indoor fundraiser where we had three guys come and we almost, I mean, I think that there it bumps up against a kind of uncomfortable tokenization, no matter what your best interests are or your best, you know, impulses and intent. And so I think that the event you saw in the fall right outside the Schnitz was a perfect example. Again, we were sort of gifted this space. We still had to pay some fees and things, but we were gifted this space that felt far fancier than we felt our organization is.
Right outside the Schnitzer Theater and the Portland Center for Five, the theaters there.
And you know, I think we belong there. I absolutely think our patrons belong there. But what we had was this juxtaposition of some folks going inside to one of the theaters for some kind of lecture. And so they were very finely dressed and paused and studied this pretty odd-looking group of people who, you know, some were spiffed up and fancy and others clearly had not been able to have a shower for some time. I think what's really interesting about that event is I had to sort of huddle with the security team ahead of that event and just say, thank you for being here. But, you know, I need to explain to you that the people you're used to bouncing and to pushing on down the block
are very much invited.
Yeah, are who this party's for. Mm-hmm. And so please make them welcome. And that was such an interesting study of faces because people definitely, you know, some were kind of shiny-eyed, like, thank you for your work. And others were clearly like, what is this crazy person talking about? You know, and so it was a beautiful event. No one had any trouble. And in fact, the manager, the house manager, circled back to say, Laura, I've never seen an event that went so well. And I really think it was because no one needed to be uninvited. No one needed to have an awkward or awful encounter because people were very, very welcomed. And so I would just say with regard to that idea of each person being a walking history full of story and value, we really do feel like everyone needs to be a part of this, a part of what the conversation around what makes our city great and what's missing, you know, the conversation about what to do next to support people who don't have housing and who are on the streets, you know. And with regard to the book, I would just say, it was so, that is an incredible thing to finally have done because that felt like this process that would never quite be cinched up. And it was actually the pandemic that gave Hodge and I the opportunity
to sit down
hunker down and finally look at that together. And so
I want to talk about the indoor event, and that's one of the major streams of financial support is through your annual fundraiser. So it takes place this year, as I mentioned, tomorrow, Tuesday, December 5th, at Up Up Books in Southeast Portland. And you have quite a group of writers, Portland-based, on the bill, along with refreshments and pie.
Yes. Can I say the writers?
Oh, sure.
This is so fun. It's Jay Ponteri, Cecily Wong, Emmett Wheatfall, Matthew Dickman, and Genevieve Hudson. And this is a thrilling thing. The Up Up Books is just a block from our headquarters. And so we're located inside the St. Francis Park apartments, and we serve the residents there. There are library patrons as well. And then we work with the Three Bikes downtown and elsewhere. But the Up Up Books and the proprietress, Michelle, has been so welcoming and has done a number of events. She's super generous with the space. But to have that lineup of writers stepping up for street books is super exciting. And like I said, because of our pivot to make our celebration with our patrons free, we have really de-emphasized the fundraising at those events. We don't want to ever have like very fine auction items that make somebody feel like, man, I'd love to participate in this, but I'm out. And so this event, this reading hosted by Michelle at Up Up Books, is an opportunity really to reach out to the community, and anyone who is able to, you know, support street books, it's very welcome. It really helps offset the cost of our celebration with our patrons. So that means a lot.
We've been talking with Laura Moulton, Executive Director and Street Librarian at Street Books, the bicycle-powered mobile library for those living outside in Portland. The Street Books annual fundraiser, Pie and Prose, takes place tomorrow, Tuesday, December 5th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Up Up Books, 1211 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. There will be readings by an all-star group of Portland-based authors with hot tea, wine, and, of course, pie provided. You can find out more about Street Books and the fundraiser on their website, streetbooks.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOOS News In Depth.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with KBOO host and documentarian Barbara Bernstein talking about her upcoming screening at St. John's Twin Cinemas on Tuesday, December 5th at 7 p.m. The documentary is Once a Braided River, How Portland Abused and Degraded the River That Runs Through It. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on to talk with us about your documentary. So, Once a Braided River tells the story of the Willamette River near its confluence with the Columbia, what it used to look like, and what European settlers did to it. Rivers are not usually in a straight line, you come to find out in this documentary. What can you tell us about that history?
I think that rivers are not in a straight line is a really good way to look at it. One of the things about nature, and particularly about water, is it doesn't flow in straight lines and right angles. It curves. It does more circular and oval kinds of things. And the Willamette River used to be what they call a braided river, hence the name of my piece, that was basically a whole complexity of islands and channels and wetlands, and particularly where the confluence of any of these rivers came, that confluence became even more complex and diverse. And it was an incredible habitat for all kinds of wildlife and plant life, and also a great place for Native Americans to live and hunt and harvest and be very happy there. So that's kind of what the river used to look like. But what happened to it when Europeans came is that they saw the river not as a huge, incredible, diverse basket of life, but instead a navigation channel. So the thing they had to do with the Willamette is to turn it into a navigation channel, because there are parts of the river, particularly close to the Columbia, where you could walk across the river. And one of my favorite images of what changed is Swan Island, which when I came to Portland, I see these signs for Swan Island. And when I went there, I went, what, where's the island? This is no island. And discovered that what used to be, Swan Island used to be an island. The place that's now connected to the east side of Portland used to be the main channel. What's now the main channel was just this place you could walk across on a bunch of little islands and all kinds of wetland areas. And that they dredged the left channel or the west channel and filled the right channel to make it Swan Island into a peninsula. And then they kept dredging the west channel to the point where you could actually put ships through it. And they've been continuing to dredge it because rivers don't really like to stay static, and so rivers will fill with silt and all kinds of stuff. And so for the last 100 plus years, probably 150 years, the Willamette River's been dredged, and if we stop dredging it, it'll go back to being a braided river.
Well, there's the dredging aspect, and then there is the exploitation for industry component that gets kind of layered on top of that as well, right?
Well, one of the things that's also very challenging to look at with the river is how what's called the banks have been hardened. So instead of being lots of wetlands and sandy beaches and places of refugia for salmon and other fish as they're swimming towards the sea to rest, both on their way to the sea and also when they're young and when they're coming back and going back to spawn. What's happened to that is that the most of the banks, particularly from downtown Portland on, actually south of downtown, have been riprapped, which is you put these giant boulders up and you tie them together and cement them together. And there's all these weird docks that are there. And so there's no place anymore that looks like a beach. You have to go down to Selwood. And across the river from Selwood, there's a little beach called Powell's Marine Park. And those are the two beaches in Portland that are remnants of what the river used to be like. There's also Poets Beach, which is a very tiny remnant that's just near the Tillicum Crossing. But not only did the river banks get devoid of any kind of vegetation, anything that would nurture any kind of wildlife, but they're also toxified because what's been going on in the river since the late 19th century is all kinds of toxic industries, whether it's shipbuilding or now it's the latest iteration of it is like all kinds of fossil fuel stuff.
Just how severe is the contamination in the Willamette River?
It's so severe that the Willamette River, the harbor, the Portland Harbor, which is the last 9 or 10 miles of the Willamette River, is the largest Superfund site in the country and the most complex. And a Superfund site is a site that is so polluted.
It's not a Superfund site.
It's a Superfund with a D, yes. It's not Superfund at all. It's actually very dangerous to hang out in a lot of parts of the beaches. There are a few beaches still, or to swim in the river there. It's very, very polluted. And that stretch of the river, it's called the North Reach, was designated a Superfund site in 2000, which means that the federal government steps in and works with the polluters, and which includes, among other things, the Port of Portland and the City of Portland, as well as all these other industries that you may or may not be familiar with, and works out a plan. And the polluters are supposed to pay, but a lot of times the taxpayers now wind up paying. It was different in the 70s when the Superfund was first created, but now the polluters have like taken control of it in a lot of ways. And so that's just an indication of just how polluted it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another component that you discuss in the documentary, what has happened to the Linton neighborhood and the introduction of the CEI hub, that industrial sanctuary, I think it's called, along the west bank of the river down from Forest Park. And, you know, listeners might know that the CEI hub has been a site of consternation for years now, particularly in the fight against Zenith Energy, but that's not the total story of the dangers of that site. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Well, the biggest danger is that there's, I think, 360 million gallons of fossil fuel, liquid fossil fuel, that's stored in these big tanks, which you'll see as you drive along Highway 30 going towards Linton and then onward to Sovie Island and Astoria. And it's on liquefaction zone, which means that it's actually, the Phil mentioned how they dredged the river. Well, a lot of those dredges wound up along the shore of the river heading towards the Columbia River. And so that what used to be beaches and wetlands, mostly wetlands, is now hardened landscape, except it's not really hard because if there's an earthquake, all of that soil is going to turn to liquid. So it's not a great idea to have these really toxic tanks, many of them which are 100 years old, storing really toxic stuff that's flammable and poisonous, and have those tanks rupture. And when the earthquake comes, which many, not just the major 10.0 earthquake, but even smaller earthquakes, it's built along right on top of an earthquake fault, and there's another earthquake fault in the West Hills, right just beyond it. And the tanks will rupture, they will spill, the contents will catch on fire. We'll have, depending on the time of year, horrible fires that could eradicate Forest Park. At the same time, that the toxins that go into the river would destroy all life in the Columbia River between Portland and the ocean.
I've heard you say that, and it's still a shock to the system.
It's a shock to me every time I think about it. I mean, it was one of these things that we live with. Those of us who have been working on this issue for a while live with it and worry about it. But it's also, I mean, I worry about what's going on in the Middle East right now, and I worry about lots of other things, and I worry about climate chaos, which, of course, this is also adding to the climate chaos. But when we do settle down and think about it, it's one of the missions of this piece is to get people to understand the incredible dangers that we live with here in Portland. And we're familiar with all these other disasters that have happened, but what could happen in Portland be a combination of the Fukushima disaster and the Deepwater Horizon.
Well, to shift tone, because this isn't the only thing that your documentary covers, is right. It's important to get the state of affairs, right? But there is hope. There are people working on this. What might restoration of the Willamette River look like?
I think the first thing to do, actually, is to start shutting down the CEI hub, the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, which is where all these tanks are being stored. And a lot of them are partially empty or empty already, but they still provide quite a hazard. So getting finding the political power, which maybe with the next election of a city council we might find, to actually start shutting down the hub, moving the really toxic materials, some of them off-site. They should all be moved off-site because it's such a dangerous place. But I think it's something that can't happen overnight, but it's something we should be working for. At the same time that we start restoring the banks of the river and creating what Bob Salinger, who's one of the people in the film and who will be at the panel discussion after the showing on Tuesday night, that the salmon don't need that much. They just need little bits of refugia every few miles, or maybe closer than that. But if we can restore parts of the banks of the Willamette River as it approaches the Columbia to a habitat that can support life, that'll be a really big change. And then the other big part is to connect people to the river. And one of the saddest places is the community of Linton, which you'll find out the secret of why Linton looks so weird when you see the movie. But people in Linton had not been able to get down to the river for many, many, many years because of the industry that encroached on Linton, starting back in 1915, I think. So getting trails down to the river, getting people to connect with the river. And I think the more people connect with the river, the more they're going to want the river to be healthy. And what I suggest to people is go down to Selwood Riverfront Park and see what a pretty healthy river system looks like. I mean, it used to be a sawmill there, and there's still pilings from the sawmill, but we weren't building ships there. And so there's not a whole legacy of toxins. And the area has been really loved back to life in the last 30 years. And when you see how the river can have beaches and have wetlands around it and forests along both sides, you start to appreciate what the river could also look like in the North Reach. And I don't think it'll ever be quite the same as in the South Reach because of all the damage that's been done and just the density of industrialization. But Cathedral Park could be as nice a park as Selwood Riverfront Park, I think, if we take charge ourselves.
Now that's a vision. Well, you've screened this documentary before. What's the response been like from folks who've come to see it?
It's been resounding. Actually, it was really thrilling. We first screened it at Cinema 21 last May, and we had an almost full house, and people really wanted to get engaged. And actually, Bob Salinger said to me after the screening, we blew it because we didn't have an action plan, what to tell people to do next. So when we showed it at St. John's Twin Cinemas in September, we were prepared, and we have these postcards you can fill out after the screening to go to all of several elected officials to demand that they take charge of getting rid of the CEI hub and also getting rid of Zenith. And so those are a couple of the focuses. And also, I think there'll probably be people there kind of helping you to figure out navigate the new electoral system for our city council and who the candidates are and how to vote for that. But people really want to act. And it was very inspiring when we showed it in St. John's, because St. John's is right across the river from the CEI hub. The wonderful park, Cathedral Park, has very polluted water. People do swim in it, but probably at their own risk. And so people there have been leading the charge along with people in Linton to shut down the CEI hub for many, many years. So it was really great to meet all these people who lived in the neighborhood who watched the film and then really want to get involved. Mm-hmm. In fact, we sold it out and we were turning away a lot of people in September. And so the people who organized the screening in September, which is Friends of Baltimore Woods, a wonderful environmental group in St. John's, they went to town to get another screening going, and like within the next week we had scheduled this one.
Okay. Well, you're also hosting a panel discussion at the screening with some of the folks who are interviewed in the documentary. What are you hoping to get from that discussion?
Well, I think it illuminates what's in the film and also gives people a chance to interact with some of the people that are in the film. And I think that's great to having that kind of dialogue. And all four of these people are very inspiring. I mean, I just feel thrilled to sit next to them and thrilled to watch the edits that I put together of them. And I think people in the audience had the same experience of really seeing how each one of these people, which are Jay Wilson, he's an emergency manager, actually, and he's one who's first people to really try to make it really public how dangerous the CEI Hub was. John Washutinsky, who's the director of sustainability for the Multnomah County, who is in a great position, has been doing really great work there. And then Bob Salinger, who's now with Willamette Riverkeeper, and Sarah Taylor, who's the co-founder of the Braided River Campaign. And just to hear them and their energy and their vision, I think, is really inspiring.
What do you want people to take away from the film?
Well, first of all, to reconnect with the river, get to know your river. And for like one thing, again, like suggesting people go to the parts of the river which are accessible, and then to help us reimagine making the rest of the river accessible, but also getting engaged in letter writing campaigns, going to hearings, testifying, particularly right now, the current battle has to do with trying to prevent the Zenith Energy from getting a clean air permit from DEQ. And they're going to be starting to take testimony relatively soon. And this other group I work with, Rumble on the River, has been running workshops on how to write testimony. So find out about that. We'll be promoting the next Rumble on the River, which is just a week, and it's 9 days after the screening, to help people to really think about the breadth of all these issues, how they all come together, and how they can get engaged.
If folks want to see the documentary for themselves, what's the best way?
Well, the best way right now, this week, is to come to St. John's Cinema, which is on Lombard Street in St. John's, and it's just a few blocks from where the St. John's Bridge dumped you off on Lombard Street. And that's next Tuesday, December 5th at 7 o'clock. Come early. We'll have some tabling so you can learn about the groups that are working to really restore our river to something that's livable and something that we can really enjoy and thrive with. And if you can't make it to the screening, you can also watch it online at onceabraidedriver.org.
If our listeners want more Barbara Bernstein, where can they find more from you?
Well, onceabraidedriver.org is my most recent work, so that's a good place to find out what I'm interested in. You can also listen to Locus Focus every Monday morning at 10, from 10 to 11 here. And a lot of the issues I cover on Locus Focus are things I wind up making documentaries about. And so the latest issue I'm really dealing with is what we're calling false climate solutions, which is what my next documentary is going to be about. So I've been doing a bunch of shows about that.
Ooh, that's big for the Barbara watchers out there, getting the preview of what the next documentary will be. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about the screening. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Althea. It's good to talk to you.
That was Barbara Bernstein, KBOO host and creator of the documentary Once a Braided River, How Portland Abused and Degraded the River That Runs Through It. It's screening at St. John's Twin Cinema in Portland on Tuesday, December 5th at 7 p.m., 8704 North Lombard Street. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Ya no pienso mantener este cariño. Ya no pienso mantener este cariño. Me parto el alma, te das la vida de placeres, y yo en mis desvelos sufriendo por amor. Y ahora resulta que porque soy lo que soy, te vas de mi lado. Si lo mejor de tu vida, lo mejor de tu vida se te escapa de las manos. Pero ¿quién te entiende? Ni tú te comprendes, ni sabes qué hacer. ¿Quieres que la mujer se someta a su hombre?
We're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO.